This is Radio Freethinker, episode 79. And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC. And I am actually going to be back on the show full time again.
Woo!
Yay for Daniel.
So, Daniel, I can hardly imagine how you rushed here in such a hurry. You use something going on?
Clever, yes. Imagine Day. It's UBC's yearly introduction to new students and old students alike. And the UBC Freethinkers have a booth set up. If you happen to be on campus right now, go check it out after you listen to the radio show, of course. We're on Main Mall around the giant Engineering E. It's good times. Gotten to a few debates with people about New World Order, 9/11 conspiracies, all that good stuff. But there's lots of people who show genuine interest. And probably one of the coolest things is that it actually is like a fairly heavy female-to-male split, which is weird. Skeptics are usually somewhat male-predominant, so maybe we'll change that, starting at UBC.
Is that why we played that song?
No, we played that song for something that's coming later in the show, but you can just sit on the edge of your sheet?
It has dual themes for our show. We're clever like that.
Right. Well, you know, it is the first day of class, so a whole bunch of new students might be listening to the show right now, and they might be saying to themselves, well, what is this Radio Freethinker? Why am I listening to this show at all? And to them I say, well, you have a very good reason to listen
money?
To our show.
Is it money?
No, it's not money.
Oh. Fame?
No.
Oh, all your friends will think you're really cool if you listen to the show.
Yes, but that's not a good reason to do anything. The reason is because Radio Freethinker is here to promote skepticism and critical thinking. We're an hour-long talk show in which we use the skeptical method along with reason and logic to understand the extraordinary claims one encounters in life, everything from religion to politics to science and history. They might be saying, okay, well, what is skepticism? What does that mean? Well, skepticism is about the search for knowledge. Its foundations are the scientific method and relying on empirical evidence. Skepticism is the approach or the process of applying critical thinking, reason, and reality to a given matter. A skeptic is someone who applies vigorous, systematic research to any claim, regardless of its political, religious, or social implications.
We really need you at the UBC Freethinkers booth. I've been having such a hard time of defining what our club is today.
You know, that took me like 3 hours to write. But we do this a lot on this show. We take on topics that most people would never, ever, ever want to talk about. And we, you know, tend to make fun of them, and it's a good time.
They're often politically incorrect to talk about or just things that people take for granted and no one questions.
Well, right. I mean, one of the big things about the idea of skepticism is so often it gets channeled only into the area of science, right? But the tools of critical thinking can be used far beyond that. I mean, even if you don't know which side of the political spectrum you're on, you can assess arguments based using the scientific method, using the idea of what's dogma, what's real evidence, and even if you come up with different opinions afterwards, at least you've all started from a solid foundation, and that's exactly where skepticism leads you.
Exactly. I mean, we're already critical of political views that we don't have, so we need skepticism and critical thinking to make us critical of the views that we have.
Well, worse than that, we tend to hold views dogmatically.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I find that almost as offensive as someone who dogmatically believes in religion or in the 9/11 conspiracies.
Right.
Is you should take everything and be able to criticize it, or at least look at it objectively. But that doesn't mean you can't believe in anything without evidence, because you just have to make sure your support is proportional to the evidence.
Right. That's the goal of our show, to promote science and to arm our listeners with the critical thinking skills and maybe light a candle in the dark out there, which is a Carl Sagan reference.
Ooh, deep.
Right. Well, let's get on with today's show. We have some really interesting topics, as Don hinted at. We're going to be talking something about Venus, maybe, in the future. But there's some interesting news. Stephen Hawking, the author of the 1988 A Brief History of Time and former Cambridge University's Lucian Professor of Mathematics, has ended the debate between science and religion once and for all.
Good.
Yeah.
And who won?
So we're done? We don't have to do this anymore?
We're basically done. Stephen Hawking has said, that's it, we're done. There is no room for God or a creator in the Big Bang. In his new book, The Grand Design, Hawking, to quote, says that because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. He rules out the existence of God, which is actually an about-face for Hawking, because he actually has made references to God in his previous work.
But has he made it like Einstein did, where it was more like God is in the rules of the universe?
Yes.
Less so than a personal God?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. He wasn't advocating for, like, the guy with the beard sitting on a cloud or anything like that.
No, well, see, I think that's one of the problems we have in our modern society is that, like it or not, we've had 1,500 years, 2,000 years of religious culture in our society. And, I mean,
More than that.
Well, the point being is that so much of that background, clouds are used as part of the background of what we talk about. So if we want to talk about, we were talking before the show about the idea of sacred. And of course, some people bristle at that term because it has really religious overtones. And it does. I mean, it is a religious term. But because it's such a common concept in our society, you might have more. This works with the same idea of God here, right? I mean, when Einstein and Poincaré and a few others used the term God, they weren't thinking of Judeo-Christian type God. They were just saying, well, there's something big and wonderful about the universe, and it is the mathematics of the universe, but isn't it really wonderful? Isn't this great all-encompassing terms? And so much of our society is just couched in religious terminology. For example, ethics. I do a lot of work in ethics, and I mean, how can you talk about ethics without bringing in, like, evil? I mean, you know, that's really a religious term.
Right. What Hawking seems to be doing here is saying that there is no room for the creator personal God. I don't know if he's completely ruling out some kind of spiritual force or not. What he's referring to when he talks about new theories is M theory, that may describe the behavior of all the fundamental particles and force, and even account for the very birth of the universe. If this theory is backed up by experiment and evidence, and that's a big if, it might perhaps replace all religious accounts of creation. And that's, again, pretty big if. It's also point out that, you know, M3 hasn't been replicated to the degree that I think most people would like to see it replicated.
Well, one of the problems with M theory and string theory before that is the limitations of being human. I mean, in order to prove some of these scientific ideas, you need to create structures that are so vast and so, at least for the moment, beyond the scope of humanity that we may never actually be able to prove their actual existence above and beyond the fact that, well, the universe exists and it follows certain laws, and this happens to go along with these laws.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how much press this is actually getting. And I guess that's understandable. I mean, Hawking is considered a genius and, like, the, you know, scientists of our time. But the press is reacting like he's ended this controversy. It's been going on for, like, 200 years.
Well, no, see, I was listening... reading something on the Telegraph, UK Telegraph, about mm-hmm. it. And the whole spin on that was almost the opposite of what you just said, is that, you know, he's opened up this can of worms, right, that you know, religion and science, well, it had learned to live with each other. Now he's saying, no, they can't live together. And the way the article was written, I mean, it was really deviously written to put a pro-religious spin on it, right? I mean, he had some lines. One line here that really irked me was, no religion has ever been rendered obsolete by facts or observation, but this happens to most scientific theories, right? I mean, it just terminology like that just says, see, religion is true, or science is true for now.
Yeah, I've seen, most of what I've seen has not acted like suddenly this is the end of the debate. It's mostly been slanted semi towards the religion and science can perfectly get along perspective that we've more or less had for a while now.
Hmm. Some of the articles I've been reading have been quite extreme in saying that sort of Hawking has either reined in the debate, or else he's started this he's lit a fire or something here, and I think it's kind of a shame, because in fact a lot of scientists for a long time have been running this argument for a while now. Hawking is, for the most part, stayed out of the God question, and now that he's suddenly involved, it's suddenly, oh, it's front page news.
Well, there is one good reason why it's front page news, is apparently he has a book for sale now, or co-authored a book. One of the actual things that I thought was interesting with the Telegraph article is it made another line that says that, and I'm quoting them, this isn't me, I think it is misleading, especially when talking about science to non-specialists, to play fast and loose with the idea of God. Perhaps it is time for a moratorium on the use of the concept in popularization, i.e., he's sort of criticizing Hawkins by bringing the God debate in because, hey, he's got a book to push and this is going to give him a lot of press to sell the book, which honestly I don't have a big problem with, because if it's a scientific book, it increases the level of intelligence in the universe. So I don't really think that's a real criticism.
They're trying to say that people shouldn't be bringing up God because God is such a loose concept?
It's the classic divide, right? Science has its truths and religion has its truths, and neither should comment on the other. I think that's where the guy was going for. And that he thought by Hawking's using the term God in a quote-unquote fast and loose way, because he obviously doesn't mean, well, I mean, he does mean God in the classic sense.
Yeah, I think he does.
I mean, obviously, so many people have slightly different versions of God that he can't fit every single one of them into his meaning. But, I mean, he's attacking something pretty generic that I think would fit most people's gods.
Most people who have a god have a creation myth. That's mostly what Hawking is, I think, talking about here.
Well, and I think, to go even stronger, what you guys are saying is, why should it be given special treatment? I mean, that's one of the whole points of Ecclesia, the atheist movement, the skeptic movement, is, I mean, if religious ideas are out there, if there are religious memes in the universe, then we should be able to criticize and challenge them just like anything else, and they shouldn't be walled off as somehow separate and special.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because Hawking is... This isn't the first time that he's created a bit of a media storm. You guys remember earlier this year when he suggested that contacting aliens would spell the destruction of humanity, suggesting that first contact with aliens, quote, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans.
He's really good at getting press coverage.
He really is. Yeah. And then, after that, he suggested that humanity's only hope for survival was to colonize other planets. And I think we even did a show about that afterwards. And basically saying that, you know, the natural resources of the planet are depleting, our genetic code carries selfish and aggressive instincts, so that we have to spread across the stars in order to survive, never mind the huge, like, 50,000 light-year distance between us and the nearest star.
Well, I think these are really three separate questions. I mean, one, there is the ultimate truth that the Earth is not here forever. And if humanity wants to exist in the long term, and probably much shorter because there are asteroids and stuff like that, if we don't leave the planet, we are doomed inevitably. Even if we don't kill ourselves, something else will.
Well, much of the sun's going to go nova.
Exactly. So in the one sense, yes, we need to go out in the universe if we want humanity to exist. The second part, which is a whole other question, is if we come across a populated planet, A, are we going to be the Spanish conquistadors or the Native Americans, mm-hmm. right? And what? How is that going? I mean, that's really shooting the rabbits. We don't know what's going to come out of that. But that's a whole other question, is are we going to repeat the mistakes of the past, and are other life forms like us to repeat our own mistakes.
Yeah, and as we said, we did talk about this a lot more in an earlier episode.
Right.
I can't remember which one. Roughly 10 episodes, I guess I'd say.
Oh, maybe more than that.
More.
You know, you should, just on that note, you should sign up to iTunes and check our archive where you can get all the fantastic shows we've done in the past because, wow, are they awesome.
Really, really awesome. Let's take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. And talking about things that are sacred and deserve special treatment, Don.
Well, you know, this was kind of inspired by our discussion last show about, you know, the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friends. Now, most atheists, if you walked up to them and said, you know, hey, how would you feel about the destruction of a whole bunch of religious textbooks? You know, something just to get rid of them from sight. You go, oh, that's great. Well, here's a way you can say no to that. A Florida-based Dove World Outreach Center. I love they have Dove in their name because that's supposed to be so peaceful. Anyhow, Pastor Tom Jones is calling for other religious groups to join him and his flock in International Burn a Koran Day to mark the 9th anniversary of the terror attacks on 9/11. Basically, what he wants to do is he wants to just make a big bonfire and burn a whole bunch of Korans just to show those Islamists that they can't take over America like they have. Or he says they have.
On the anniversary of the Crusades, can we burn Bibles?
I do that. I have a nice little wiener roast. It's very funny. I mean the parallels to this with the Islamic Community Center being built in New York was kind of bizarre. But there's a lot more because, I mean, one of the things that they had said, General Caldwell of the American Army said, there's no question about the First Amendment rights. That's not an issue. The question is, what is the implications over here? And over here, he means Afghanistan. Is it going to jeopardize the men and women serving in Afghanistan? General Petraeus says that it's precisely this kind of action the Taliban uses, not here in Afghanistan, not only here in Afghanistan, but everywhere in the world, to engage the Islamic community to promote its radical idealism. It just struck me as really bizarre. I mean, here the people. I mean, peaceful, love, religion, great. Let's promote hatred throughout the world.
I am surprised that General Petraeus is saying something like that, because it almost errs on the side of saying things that the U.S. does is what's leading to Islamic extremists to attack the U.S., which there have been some politicians in the U.S. and some other people who have said similar things and have just been, like, torn apart by everyone else. Like, oh, the U.S. can't be to blame. Nothing we do here might lead to people hating us.
You might not have noticed it, but George Bush isn't in office anymore. So they're a little bit looser on that. Glenn Beck will still slam him for it. But no, it's not quite as that. But yeah, but that's there are implications to our actions that sometimes go beyond what we intend them to be, right? I mean, even if this is a valid form of, I don't know, retribution.
Social protest,
right? It has ramifications in the rest of the world that you should be aware of and mm-hmm. take into consideration, because you may actually be doing more harm to your own cause. I mean, I'm assuming this Pastor Jones or whatever is a, you know, patriotic American as well as a quote-unquote really devout Christian. And I mean, you know, what's the whole point of this if it's going to shoot yourself in the foot?
Right. Well, I mean, there's also the aspect of, you know, I don't think for a second that a holy book is deserving of special treatment, but just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. You know, getting, you know, I could eat a squirrel, for instance. I mean, I should eat a squirrel.
There are thousands of fifth graders out there who say, no, you're wrong. Just because I can do something, I should be able to do it, just for the heck of it.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't, well, so this is probably going to be something we're going to hear more about, because, I mean, 9/11 is just around the corner. They probably are going to continue with their protests, because the United States has gone slightly to the nut side. More so, I mean, it's hard to believe, having lived through George Bush, that you could say that the United States can get crazier than it has. But there are elements on it that have gone crazier than it has. And I don't know. It's just, it's going to be interesting. And sadly, I suspect we will be hearing more about this. In fact, I was reading just the other day a bizarre article in a way. Apparently, the first chaplain has been killed in Afghanistan. It's the Afghanistan, Iraq. There's only one for both of those, Afghanistan, Iraq war. Lots more have been killed in other wars, but this is the first one. And they made a big thing about it. But I think it was the New York Times, or it could have been another American paper, did this whole article about how one of the security people, the sort of a buddy for a chaplain, the idea is he's like the bodyguard, is an atheist, and the pastor, of course, isn't. And there was this big conflict between them because the chaplain says, you know, I don't know if I could really work with someone who's an atheist or whatever, right? Because it just goes against my fundamental beliefs. And then they just basically said yes. But he's a really good bodyguard, and he'll probably save your life. And he went, well, okay. it was kind of bizarre. I'll try and get that article and put it on our website just so you can check it out.
So back to the chaplain who died. Was he? It wasn't a targeted.
It wasn't a targeted. He was, if I'm remembering correctly here, he was part of a group of soldiers that were killed by an IED or.
Yeah. So I mean, it's sad, certainly, that someone's dying, but it seems like it's being blown out of proportion. Lots of people die.
Well, that's true.
That's not good, obviously.
although apparently it is the first one, and considering this is America's longest war, in one sense, that's actually quite remarkable, especially considering the religious overtones. I mean, you said, is this a targeted thing? And you'd think there might have been targeting about it, but
It's the longest war that's not really a war?
Yeah, well, Korea had a lot more chaplains killed in it, too, and that was not really a war. That was just a police action.
Right.
And I don't know, what was Vietnam again? Was that a war?
That was a war.
Yeah, okay.
War was never declared.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. I thought, they just got, like...
The last U.S. declared war was, I think, Korea.
Korea was a UN police action.
That was World War II.
What about Panama?
That was probably police action.
Yeah, we should probably actually do more research before we say for sure. But it's been a long time since the U.S. has declared a war, that's for sure.
Okay. Interesting.
Although he did... We're wandering here. Let's continue on.
Right. Well, in other cool news, cool skeptical news that doesn't involve people dying, we've discovered something new in Egypt. And it's actually going to rewrite some history books. And this all began...
Isn't it something old, probably?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's why you rewrite the history books. If it was new, no one would care. This all began when a husband and wife team of John and Deborah Darnell started following some ancient roads out of modern-day Luxor that seemed to just lead nowhere. And so they followed the roads, they tracked them, they started discovering pottery and items left over by people who had made camps along these roads during the time of the pharaohs. And they were slowly but very surly discovering a whole network of trading that went on in the middle of the desert. And, you know, this was kind of like the middle of the desert, why would you be out there? So they discovered this huge area of oases. Oases?
Oasi.
Oasi?
Maybe.
Sure. And what they've discovered is the remains of a settlement, apparently an administrative, economic, and military center that flourished more than 3,500 years ago in the western desert, about 100 miles west of Luxor and 300 miles south of Cairo.
And no one ever noticed this before?
No such urban center so early in history has ever been found that deep in the desert.
Wow. Do you have a rougher date? Because you said during the time of the pharaohs. That's like saying during the time of Christians in Europe.
Sure. What's surprising about this settlement is that it was flourishing during what is sort of considered Egypt's Dark Age, sort of right in a transition period between, I believe, the Middle Dynasty and the High Kingdom or whatever.
About 3,500 years ago, yeah. Right? That's a number that I saw.
Yeah. Well, it was. I'll look it up and get more on the show notes. Anyway, what they've discovered here in terms of artifacts have indicated this settlement was actually permanently inhabited. It wasn't seasonal or temporary. And they've also discovered a lot of baking artifacts. So they decided to name this place Mawar. Mawagir. I don't know what that means. But in Arabic, it means mother of bread molds. So nice little touch there. This discovery significantly changes past notions of Egyptian history. This period, as I mentioned, was something known as the Dark Age for Egypt. And this discovery of using oasis and trading roads is very important for how the Egyptian Empire flourished and eventually became extremely dominant in the Mediterranean. The traces of the administrative buildings, grain silos, storerooms, artisan workshops, and foundations of many identified structures are a treasure trove of archaeology and anthropology that will no doubt be studied for decades to come. So it's very interesting information that's been unearthed here in the sands of Egypt.
The two things, actually, I thought was interesting. One, just so people don't think that this couple are crazy, this is sort of what they do. They've been hired before, and they've written books about the travel and road routes in this part of the world. So they just weren't sitting there one day going, let's go for a walk and just travel down this road to where it happened to end, somewhere in the middle of the desert. This is kind of their shtick.
If you look at the way they found this out, right? They found these roads that lead nowhere. So that's confusing. Let's do some investigation. They didn't jump from roads to Atlantis, for instance. They jumped from roads. So, okay, well, is there anything left on the sides of these roads? So they found some pottery. Okay, well, that's interesting.
And then they jumped to thinking that it was an Egyptian stimulus package?
Maybe.
Well, I'm wondering, where did the aliens come into this?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they have to
they
be.
They don't. See, that's the interesting thing. There are no aliens in this story.
But I do have a conspiracy theory for you.
Okay.
I was doing some research beforehand. And did you know in the same neck of the woods, there is a Persian. Duras is Persian, right? Or Babylonian. Persian. Persian temple set up in the same area 2,500 years ago.
Well, that is because Persia conquered Egypt during this time period, which is why this is kind of surprising to see a flourishing center of trade and commerce.
1,000 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. So, very interesting study, a very interesting discovery, and I think very cool.
Yes, definitely.
Why don't we go to a commercial break and we'll be back with something to do with Venus.
Yes.
Maybe involving aliens. Who knows?
Hi, this is Randy Randall from No Age. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks a lot.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Stay above the flat line, I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of the sunshine with me on a red-eye flight to another world. Isn't any trouble if you wanna come with me? You can get what you want now, knock it out of the park. Buried by the river, easy, there's a search party, but it's getting dark. Stay above the flat line,
So, ahead of the curve, we've got another one by popular demand. We're going to be talking about the Venus Project. Get the connection with the song, Venus. Venus Project.
Yes.
Now, you might be wondering why this is an ahead of the curve thing. Well, apparently there's a seminar coming on October 23rd on the Venus Project. What's the Venus Project, you might ask? The Venus Project, well, where I first came to know about it, and this raised alarm bells, was by a film by Peter Joseph. Anyone know Peter Joseph? Famous for...
Somewhat.
Yes.
Famous for Zeitgeist, the movie, and Zeitgeist Amendum. And apparently he's got a new one coming out called Zeitgeist Moving Forward or something. But in the addendum part, he introduces this idea of the Venus Project. And I went, uh-oh. Because, I mean, if you know anything about Zeitgeist, it's kind of conspiracy wacko stuff,
well,
right?
What is Zeitgeist, for those who don't know?
Zeitgeist, the movie, is basically about three main things. About how religion is out to dominate humanity, and it's just historical baggage. How money and the financial monetary institutions are run by an elite to dominate people. And that there is a conspiracy about 9/11, among other things, to, can you guess, dominate and control people. There's a sort of reoccurring theme amongst the Zeitgeist. So when the Venus Project thing came out, right, I said, well, okay, I got some red flags about this here, right? But if you go and you look at any of the information, it's actually quite different, quite surprising. So much so that they even have a thing where they have the Zeitgeist movement. Again, red flags, Zeitgeist, hey, it must be the same as a movie. But no, apparently it's, for some reason, these people are using the very similar terms, and they're kind of interrelated. But the Project Venus is very much of a, I'm going to use the term utopian, but the founder of the project, a guy named Jacques Fresco, who in the 70s started this, he's now 94 years old, and very famous. We all probably know about him, because in 42, him along with another guy named Lou Glaser started the Revel Plastic Company. Anyone has any models at home, planes or ships or cars? Probably a Revel. Anyhow, he started this idea of sort of a utopia long before the Zeitgeist movement came about. And it's actually very socialistic, very utopian. It has a number of goals that it plans to bring out. So how about I go through some of them?
Please.
Well, the first one, and this, of course, will make Daniel really happy, is he wants to replace the money-based nationalistic economies with a resource-based economy.
Yes.
Okay, so...
The explanation of what exactly that is pretty horrible.
Well, a resource-based economy is, in a sense... Well, resources become the important means of exchange, although he doesn't like the idea of exchange even that, and money no longer exists. That everyone owns everything equally, right? And I know you're sitting there saying, communism. No, he hates communism too. I'm not sure why, but he hates it because he considers it to be an authoritarian regime, whereas he's not.
Yes, we have different overlords under him, but I guess we'll get to that.
Well, see, his main premise, and actually this is one I think is hard to argue against, is that there are enough resources on the planet that you could feed everyone, you could house everyone, you could clothe everyone. And that the reason why we have scarcity isn't because there's a lack of resources, but because we use a monetary system, I'm using finger quotes here, a monetary system of distribution that creates haves and have-nots, and that he would do away with this, or he hopes humanity would do away with this. Like I say, he's very old. This isn't really an ego thing, I think, for him. It's just... So that's one of the main things. And he says that because modern society has highly advanced technology, that this is all very doable. That the reason why we have money, it's largely just a social convention. And that money in itself is not a natural resource, nor does it represent one. It's not necessary for our survival. Which, on the one hand, is true. But on the other hand, some people have knocked his analogy about islands.
Yeah, in it, he is... He brings up sort of a thought experiment for people who are having trouble with the notion of giving up on money, like me. And basically what the thought experiment is, a bunch of people are stranded on an island. They have a bunch of gold coins with them. The gold coins are absolutely useless on the island. And yeah, sure, the gold coins are pretty much useless on an island when you need food and other such stuff. But that doesn't mean they couldn't be useful in the future on that island once these the people who are stranded start making food, are catching food and building things, they can use them to trade the resources.
Well, true, but I think his idea, and this is where you're right, it's the details become very complicated, but why do you need that middle part? Why do you need the money to create false...
Well, what about things that go bad, like crops? Mm-hmm. Like potatoes.
Well,
if you make potatoes.
He doesn't even want a barter economy either. Which is really confusing to me. Like, you're talking about the major alternative to straight up money, which is bartering. Like, you give a service to someone, in return they give you some of their crops that they had. But he doesn't even want that.
But I mean, if you make potatoes, though, your product is going to decompose after a certain amount of time. You only have a limited opportunity to quote, trade them for whatever you want to get. Mm-hmm. That puts you at a pretty big disadvantage against somebody who, like, builds houses, for instance.
True. But, well, you see, one of the things, too, and anyone who's known me for a long time, there is a great analogy to this. Has anyone ever seen this show called Star Trek?
Where
at least in the original versions, right, there was no money. Everyone, you had your job, you did your job, you got your resources as you needed them, and there was no real currency, there was no real barter. It was just, you did it because that's just the way things were done.
I would point out, though, that I've actually read a paper by libertarian types on Star Trek, and how in Star Trek, no matter what comes out of it, eventually some form of money will appear. And in Star Trek, they trade holodeck time because it is the one limited one limited resource they have. Food is plentiful, other things are plentiful, but holodeck time is limited, and they trade that between each other for things, which is just as much of a form of currency as anything else.
And in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, they actually did have a currency.
Yeah.
So,
but of course, there is the other aspect, too, to all this, that even if we acknowledge your holodeck trading time currency thing, mm-hmm. that's one millionth of their quote-unquote economy, mm-hmm. if you can term that.
Yeah.
But, of course, you do bring up another very interesting thing, and how do we allocate resources? I mean, this has become the modern thing. People have been doing it for thousands and thousands of years without an economy, yeah. but modern society seems to require an economy. But he's got this one solved. He's got this one solved because, you know, again, he's fairly technological. I mean, he's really big in technology. If you ever go to the website, thevenusproject.com, and you look at the graphics, it looks like something from 1950s science fiction world. It's really, really up there. But he would replace politicians with a cybernated society in which all physical entities are managed and operated by computer systems, i.e., computers would allocate and run and do everything. But he also wants to note that the only area that the computers do not operate or manage is the surveillance of people, because he's also quite paranoid of governments. One of the things he wants to get rid of is the abolition of dominant institutions, government, religion, and money.
See, this strikes me as adding so many variables to the equation. Why not, instead of having robots that don't want to monitor humans, just have humans who don't want to monitor humans? Why do you need robots?
Well, I think the idea is that if you have humans in control in any way, somehow you're going to have some working towards the benefit of a minority. And I think that's partly what he's getting at. And I will give him props compared to a lot of grand socialist type ideas. He is at least trying to put into place a plan for dealing with scarcity of resources, which is often ignored. I won't talk about this too much, but if you look it up, back in, I believe, the 20s or 30s, there was huge debates when socialism was really starting to emerge between economists like Ludwig von Mises and prominent socialist thinkers about how you could possibly divvy up limited resources, limited time, without money. And ultimately, I think you can pretty objectively say that Ludwig von Mises and the economists and Austrian school back then sort of won that debate. It no longer became something socialists would prominently talk about because they were hurriedly dismissed by most people. It became sort of the major belief that you need money in order to transfer goods in a large society. And it sort of seems like he's trying to get around this problem by saying that computers will be able to divvy up the resources, will be able to use robots to cultivate food, to make housing for people. And so people almost not have to work, and so they won't have to sort of trade their work for goods at the end of the day.
There are three aspects to this, and I think we've touched on the one, is the idea of allocations, and computers would be able to do the allocating. One of the advantages of computers, besides their technical abilities, is their impartiality, which Ethan kind of touched on, is one of the problems every other revolution has, be it right or left, is you have a leader, and a leader is a human, and humans tend to, especially because we come from a culture of individualism, of selfishness, tends to make things go in an unequal condition, right? So, I mean, so the idea of the robot is the robot would be impartial in its allocation. So not only would it do it to the best efficiency, but it wouldn't have any, it has no stake in the game, so it doesn't really care where it goes, so there's no bias. It's not going to give more to its children.
What's the basis for assuming that a robot's not going to say, hold on a second, you're taking up all this room that I could be building my robot clones in? Like,
well, I assume their plan is not to program the robot to become self-aware, but
is that slavery then?
Even small things like living along, say, a river area where there's little natural resources, it's cheaper to live there to an extent because it's easier to transport goods there. There's less of a chance that your house is going to be destroyed by flooding. Well, by a river there might be flooding, but let's say by tornadoes or hurricanes or whatever. Like, living in New Orleans is going to, by necessity, sort of cost a little extra. It might happen only once every 10 years, but ultimately there's extra cost to living there, and a monetary system deals with that by prices changing, by people who want to live in these better areas having to give up more in terms of other things. Whereas for his thing, what if someone wants to live in New Orleans? They're going to be taking up more resources and more time to live there than Vancouver never has natural disasters.
He's got this solved. Okay, because this is the third aspect to his technological solution to all our problems, is right now we waste so much resources and energy on non-productive things, be it luxury goods, which would be the obvious thing, but I mean, you think of the military, right? In the United States, there was a $3 trillion spent on bank bailouts and that sort of thing, right? Well, if you channeled that money into building environmentally efficient buildings, because if you go to the website, he's really big on future tech as far as buildings go. He's got this big city plan, how you develop a city, and it becomes cost-effective because there's a lot of reproduction of parts. You know, you build one house, and then you clone that house 50 times, and that brings down the cost. So the added expenses you're bringing into, there would be the real added expenses, as in if a flood comes, destroys your house, you have to rebuild the house. But that would be more than compensated for the fact that because you have a house in a good neighborhood, would no longer have any value in and of itself. It would just be a neighborhood.
But okay, the computer happens to choose for you to live in Florida, and you get to be right along a nice, beautiful beach, one of the best in the world. Are you going to have to limit yourself in terms of how many other goods you can get? Because the way a monetary system works for this is you're going to be paying more for that, so you have to give up somewhere else in order to live there. For him, is he just going to somehow make it so people don't like beaches a ton anymore, so it evens out, like, psychologically rather than monetarily?
You are so wrapped up in the current, you know, capitalistic consumerist society system that you don't see the fact that the actual real differences in the resources required for these things are really insignificant, and that where it becomes significant is because we add on this monetary system. A beachfront house costs 20,000 times more than one in the middle of the prairies because we have a monetary system where actually the houses themselves, there's very minor differences in actual construction, even if you taken the fact that the one in Florida gets wiped out every so often because of a hurricane.
Even ignoring the fact that, even saying that house costs, everything, the food costs, all that will be the exact same between two places. I want to live in Florida. I don't want to live in Minnesota. But this robot thing isn't going to take that into consideration.
But why? No. Why do you think it wouldn't take your aspirations and your desires into consideration? It would weigh them as it would any other aspect of it, right? Or at least, again, we're assuming it would, right? So right now, do you want to live where you live right now? No, you are forced to live there by circumstance. So if you switch the circumstance from a monetary system to a computerized system, at least you know you are getting treated equally with everywhere else, whereas you get screwed because you get underpaid at your job. And we know you haven't been showing up for the radio show because of your job. Well, a computer would take all that into consideration, and we'd live happily ever after.
I could very well move if I wanted to. I don't see where this is coming from. In fact, it'd probably be cheaper to live in many other places, but I like Vancouver.
Florida? Florida? You moving to Florida?
Yeah.
You seem to have a thing for beachfront property.
I'm just saying, there's major psychological differences. Sure, you could argue some will disappear once you get rid of, like, all the mass marketing stuff. Like, maybe I'm not going to want my Xbox anymore, but...
Why would you not? You still can have your Xbox. He's not saying you can't have the Xbox.
Is everyone going to have an Xbox then? What about some people? Some people don't want the Xbox. They want a doll set.
Right. So all this will be taken into the calculation. And that's why...
What if there's only a few doll sets left, though? Who gets them then?
Yeah.
Whoever has the greatest need.
How do you determine that?
Algorithm. Quantum mechanical computers will...
Deepak.
No. So you're bringing up some very interesting things, but I don't think they're insurmountable as you make them sound. And more importantly, I'm not sure that you've really convinced me that the monetary system solves these problems better. So you still would have the problems, maybe, but I don't think that they would, A, would be worse problems, and B, I think, at least in principle, you could compensate for people's preferences, at least as well as you do
I'll
now.
I'll be the first to admit that obviously the monetary system isn't absolutely perfect at allocating resources to people who want to pay and can pay. But this system, like, let's just think about it. How infinitely complex our modern economy is. To make a pencil, which is a really common sort of economic thought experiment, there's probably not a single person in the world.
Friedman lied about that. Pencils are easy to make. Friedman came up with that example. I know what you're going at. Okay. Pencils are the simplest things in the world to make. Just because you're an economist who is we're going off the track here. I'm going to pull us back a bit.
I don't think we're going off the track.
No.
Well, actually,
we're doing good.
Nevertheless, regardless of how better or worse the current economic system is, the point here is that this guy is making a claim that a computer running the world is a better choice. He requires evidence for this claim, and he has not presented any.
Oh, he has.
What?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Because we're having a great debate about economic systems here, and we all know that Daniel's wrong. But he's got some other things, aspects to this, which will help bring out things. Okay, so first of all, one of the things he believes, he also holds that this new world will have, is there'll be assistance in stabilizing the world population through education and voluntary birth control. Sharing of new technologies between have and have-not countries, right? Development of clean and renewable energy resources, which we kind of have. We just tend not to spend as much money on it as we should. What's the other thing? And this is the big one here. Arrival at methodologies by careful research rather than random opinion. So one of the reasons why he separates himself, or he claims to separate himself from communism or fascism and all that, is that he thinks the best way ultimately to run society is based upon the scientific method, which kind of was a good thing. Again, there's a lot of gray in there. But I mean, at least in principle, he's saying, you know, we need to scientifically determine what is the best way to run things and then go with that, instead of saying von Mises is great, no, Marx is great, no...
But that's still not evidence. That's basically saying, you know, this society will use slants. That's well and good. But how is it objectively, how are you going to, how is the society objectively going to make anything better.
Okay, I have a brilliant idea. Okay, we attach electrodes that measure the electric pulse in our brain that is giving us happiness feelings, and then we attach that to the computer network, and then we try and give everyone the exact same level of happiness. So if one person drops a little, we give them more food, another Xbox, some more Xbox games, until their happiness level goes up to the level of everyone else's.
Well, isn't that better than saying, well, we'll just wait for divine providence? I mean, I know you did that as sort of a, oh, this is a ridiculous thing, and I think the practicality of it would be impossible to do. But I mean, in principle, why is that worse than saying Bill Gates has more money, therefore he should have more control over how resources are allocated? Because largely people like him are the famous one, basketball player, I can't remember his name right now.
Michael Jordan?
No, well, we'll say Michael Jordan. Why is Michael Jordan rich? Well, he's not really rich for anything other than in our society, basketball happens to be popular. If he was born 200 years ago, he'd be a poor apple picker or something, right? Well, so there's that aspect. But I think...
Can I say something quickly?
Yeah.
Back to your point like a second ago. Ultimately, whether you like this or not, whether you like libertarianism, whether you like something that lends towards a more equitable distribution of resources, it's kind of ultimately a moral question. And you can certainly use evidence and reason for that. And there's people who might debate that there's sort of a objectively right version based off of morals. But ultimately, I think it's you can't exactly define society based off of an objectively better position.
I think ultimately where we can kind of end this, I went into this Venus Project seeing it's part of the Zeitgeist, the movie Zeitgeist, and then I'm going, oh my God, bunch of conspiracy nut crazy people. And I suspect if you go to the Venus Project conference that they have here, there probably will be a large number of those kind of people here. But I think, judging by the spirited debate we have here...
What day is it again?
It's the 23rd of October. $25 to go to it. I'm not exactly
same
sure.
Same day as Skeptic Camp, I believe.
Yeah, I'll be going to Skeptic Camp.
I'm going to hold that out as an open question. although it's in the evening. Is Skeptic Camp in the evening?
No, Skeptic Camp's during the day.
Yeah.
Well, it goes to about 6 or something.
Irrespective. I just thought this was... I went into this with a bunch of preconceptions about how this is going to be some conspiracy nut project. And although you may disagree with it in some aspects, it doesn't seem to be a crazy nut thing, even if it is somewhat utopian in its vision.
I don't think it's a crazy nut vision. I just think that he's making pretty wild allegations that he's not providing any evidence for.
I don't think he's making allegations. He's saying aspirations.
Assumptions, maybe. I think that it's sounds like a good topic for a video game, like maybe like BioShock or something. But, I mean, there really isn't... I don't see too much scientific evidence that would convince me that I should have a robot giving me Xboxes when I get upset. But...
I think just to close out on this, just to he's got one, he had two thoughts that I thought were very contradictory, and an overall part of it. He has on the website, he says, it's not enough to criticize or point out the shortcomings of society, Ethan, but to appoint people of high moral character to office. This would do little to advance civilization. So you go, okay, great. You need to do something. But then, of course, the next line he has later on down is that rhetoric and paper proclamations are irrelevant in the management of human society or social affairs. And ultimately, and I think this is where we all kind of agree on the same page, that he's got a lot of great ideas on paper, or he's got a lot of ideas on paper here, but they seem to end up in rhetoric. I mean, he's been promoting this idea since the 70s, right? And he's had a lot of weight behind it since 2000 or so. But it does still seem to be rather rhetorical in nature, and a lot of pie in the sky things.
Yeah.
Although I support it.
I don't hate all of... I like some of his goals, basically. I just don't think it can work. And I don't know. That's basically it.
Well, why don't we go for our last commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with our skeptical highlights of the upcoming events here in Vancouver. I'm ahead of the curve. Take a piece of
sunshine with me on an all-night drive. Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring?
That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa!
How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa!
When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa!
A+, here I come.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So let's check out our skeptical highlights. This is where we give you some ideas for upcoming events and activities that you can hang out with.
Let me start, because I seem to have come across in that last segment as the crazy one. So let me come across here as continuing the crazy. Now, some people may or may not remember, but a few years ago, there was a big incident happened in New York on September 11th. Well, apparently Vancouver's 9/11 Truth Society is having their annual conference on what day? Anyone guess?
September 11th.
September 11th at 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Robson Square. I think it would be a hoot to show up and just sort of see how crazy really works. But
yeah, based off of today, I mean, it's fun talking to these people. It's fun.
Okay. Yeah, so, they're not threatening you in any way. I actually have a high optic place on September 11th, and that is the CFI Book Club is meeting at the Grind Coffee Shop at 1 p.m., and they'll be discussing the physics of Star Trek. And we talked about Star Trek today, so there you go. And that's the book by Lawrence Krauss, who was here in Vancouver not too long ago to give a fantastic talk. That's on the 11th at the coffee shop, the Grind Coffee Shop. And then on September 18th, CFI has Cafe Inquiry, and the subject of this one is going to be the Black Hole of Calcutta, which is all about what you would do if you were on an island or on a raft somewhere and you only had so many resources, and who would you pick to keep on your raft? So also quite relevant to today's discussion. That's going to be on the 18th at 11 a.m. at SFU Harbor Center.
Sorry. I bring the gold.
I'm confused. I mean, I know the Black Hole of Calcutta. What's the connection between that and sort of lifeboat Earth?
You'll have to show up and see.
Okay.
Yes.
And I have two events, one which is still going on. If you happen to be on UBC or close for the next roughly 30 minutes, you should run down to the UBC Freethinkers Imagine Day booth next to the big engineering E and come say hi, join our mailing list, take some free stuff, and or you can go see other booths. Other booths are cool too. But this Thursday, the UBC Freethinkers are having their first big event of the year. We're teaming up with the SFU Skeptics, and we're having acclaimed LGBT, which is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual skeptic, Greta Christina, in town on Thursday, September 9th. She's giving a lecture on atheism and sexuality at SFU from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m., at AQ3005, if you happen to know what that is. And then later that day, from 7 to 9 p.m., she'll be at UBC giving one on diversity in the atheist movement, basically talking about how our movement can be at times a bunch of mostly white men, of which our show is guilty, and how we should probably do stuff to change that. And it's not so much that there aren't women and people of other races who are sympathetic to our skeptical movement, but it might be stuff we're doing that is keeping them out. And that's at Woodward Lecture Theater 3, 7 p.m. And both of these are free, but feel free to give a donation or join our clubs if you want to support us.
Right, and Club Days is coming up next week, I believe?
No, Club Days isn't until, I think it's September 22nd to 24th. I'll get the exact dates and times for next week's show. The AMS hasn't decided everything yet.
I see.
It'll be roughly around the days I said.
Excellent. And the UBC Freethinkers will have a booth there, so you guys can hang out and recruit and all that kind of stuff.
We have buttons that you can win if you if you know the definitions of homeopathy and reflexology and such.
Excellent. Well, that's our show today. I encourage our listeners, if you enjoyed it, check us out on iTunes. You can go to our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com to read our blogs and show notes. You can also follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And that's a great way to keep in contact with us and let us know what you think. You can also find us on Facebook. You can become a fan or a like or whatever it does on Facebook.
Whatever Facebook is up to
now. I don't know what Facebook does, but we're up there. And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Daniel saying come check us out at the Imagine Day booth, unless you're listening on podcast.
Very good. Thank you, Daniel.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away.
CITR 101.9 FM.